from WPFW News in Washington. I'm Sue Goodwin.
Afternoon, Washington, D.C., Maryland, Virginia, wherever you are tuned in, you are listening to Taking Action here on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C. As always, thank you all for tuning in and for your support. We really do appreciate it, especially as we close out the year. We reflect and just want to thank everybody for their listenership and for their ongoing support. Today, I am honored to have on with me, we have Cynthia Ku. She is the Senior Associate at the Center on Privacy and Technology at the Georgetown University of Law. I'm also joined by Ben Winter, who is the Senior Counsel at EPIC, the Electronic Privacy Information Center. And today, we'll be talking about a topic that really has caught my attention, algorithmic discrimination. And they have an event coming up this Friday that we'll touch on, but really wanted to get into the details of algorithmic discrimination, which I'm like, man, if they can find another platform to discriminate against people, they will. So thank you both, Cynthia and Ben, for making the time to join us this afternoon and to educate us about this important topic.
Thank you so much for having us.
Of course. Yeah, thanks.
So, you know, as somebody who often hears the word algorithm, and of course, most of us are very familiar with discrimination, I wonder if we could just do a little kind of just level setting for the audience and talk about like what is an algorithm, and then more directly get into, you know, how is it being used to discriminate against folks here in the district, and I would imagine around the world, but we're focusing in the district today. So, I don't know, Cynthia or Ben, if you want to start us off giving us just an understanding of what an algorithm is, and then we can go from there.
Sure. So essentially, an algorithm is a formula. You put in A, B, or C, and you get out X, Y, or Z according to certain rules. If it's a computational formula, which is the type of algorithm we're talking about, then in some cases, they have been programmed to give you certain outputs given certain inputs. In other cases, they are programs so that you're not explicitly telling them the rules that the computer algorithm should follow, but telling them to extract patterns from massive amounts of data that you give to them. So a computer algorithm, which is the type that we will mostly be talking about today, is basically like when you set up an Excel spreadsheet formula, you are instructing the computer to do something with a cell. But the difference and why algorithmic discrimination is such an important topic now is because you're not just asking these software algorithms to do your taxes or to do a calculation for you. You're asking them to judge someone on whether or not they'll be a good tenant, whether they should go to jail, or whether they deserve a loan or not.
Yeah, and I can expand on that a little bit, in that algorithms are sort of used throughout the whole housing life cycle, as you can imagine. Like as Cynthia mentioned, at the very outset, algorithms and other a lot of times the terms is automated decision making systems, to more generally refer to algorithms or, you know, simple sort of spreadsheets, like a recipe is another way a lot of people use to describe algorithms. But that is for evaluation of sort of credit and suitability risk, whatever that means. A lot of times we don't actually know. For tenants, that happens for valuation of homes. It happens for setting rent prices throughout different cities. and, you know, it happens both in private contexts, but also, and including in DC, you know, public benefits programs, like public housing, other certain things like that, also use like tenant screening tools that are run through an algorithm that may prevent somebody from being able to secure the housing they're entitled to, and at the very least, do not allow that individual to get that housing without subjecting themselves to the additional data collection around the algorithm or to the decisions or recommendations that algorithm creates.
Thank you for that. You know, as I delved a little deeper into some of the, and thank you both for sending some materials to read on. Basically, you know, I guess let's give folks an understanding, and then I want to share one of the stories from the report that your organization published, Ben. Talk to us a little bit about like how we sometimes unwittingly, unknowingly are giving our information, right? We create a Facebook account and we think we're connecting with our high school buddy or, you know, grandma or your aunt that lives on the other side of the country, but that information is being used. Am I correct in making that assumption, or just maybe walk us through a little bit how we give up some of our information that is being used to create these algorithms?
Yeah, you are absolutely correct. So one of the things that distinguishes big data when that first became a thing so many years ago, and now algorithmic decision-making system, is something that people will call the three Vs, which stand for volume, velocity, and variety. Before, that referred to what made big data different from what distinguished it before, and I would suggest that algorithmic decision-making has only upped the ante on those three factors. So which refer to data. So when you think of variety of data, it's your Facebook posts, your Instagram posts, your browsing history, your purchases at CVS. If you have any time you have a loyalty program at any store, that feeds into data brokers. If you have a criminal record, eviction record, any kinds of records, there is a whole ecosystem that it could take an entire other podcast episode to go through of data brokers that traffic in all of the types of personal data that we both willingly give online or are forced to give online just as part of functioning in everyday life. And then they get repackaged and sold as profiles and as analytics to feed these types of algorithmic decision-making systems that purport to make inferences and predictions about people based on all of these statistical generalizations. And then to bring it back to the other two Vs, velocity is because this happens faster and faster. Even if you look at some of the tenant screening algorithms that we'll be talking about or that Ben has mentioned, these reports are generated almost instantaneously. And then of course, volume is because there's just more and more data being generated and more computational capacity to process it all far beyond human capability. And so all of these things, even though discrimination is an age-old concern, it adds an additional dimension that we did not have to deal with before these technologies existed.
Wow, wow. Thank you for that, Cynthia. Ben, in your report, well, not in your specifically, but I know you were a part of developing the report titled Screened and Scored in the District of Columbia. There is a what I feel is a very concerning story about a young man named Juan who falls into being unhoused and for different reasons. But the process of getting resources creates this profile for him, this algorithm for him that actually does not help him. Talk to us a little bit about that, because I think that was a great, the vignette that you all share in that report is a great way of explaining how this works.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, so that report was really an effort to try to illustrate the breadth of automated decision-making tools and algorithms that are used, that are sort of unavoidable, that are endorsed by the government, that are, you know, essential and required to get the most basic government services. And this example, which is a vignette, you know, sort of cobbled together from a bunch of real stories, and common stories from other jurisdictions as well, is something that really could happen and could illustrate how the person, you know, an individual's life is really affected by outsourcing decisions to the algorithms and deferring, you know, requiring, you know, a lot of data collection, requiring people to subject themselves to this decision-making process. And so there was a few different related algorithms that someone in his situation would, you know, be connected with in DC. So one is the VSPIDAT. That is the Vulnerability Index and Service Prioritization Decision Assistance Tool. So I can try to say that a few times fast, but essentially what that does, it tries to prioritize it tries to create a numerical score, like 1 to 10, about how vulnerable a person that is unhoused is, and therefore that will help bring people on a list of who would get limited resources. In theory, this might you know, sound good because of the limited resources, but in reality, there is this really long list of hyper-personal questions that people are asked to disclose information about, which all just sort of gets like mishmashed into a number. And that number might be the difference between whether someone gets a spot in a shelter, whether they get money towards rent, things like that. And so there is that. And then even if you are able to get into the sort of housing, rental, and search process for tenants, you are also then, you know, having to give your information to this sort of magic formula that says whether you're trustworthy or rent-worthy or whatever that be, whatever that may be. But in reality, you know, sometimes that report that was generated by, you know, the company that gives that score on you might be literally inaccurate. It might include information about eviction history, criminal history, things that are otherwise not allowed to be considered, but if it's like sort of folded into this algorithm that is not required to be public and transparent, then you have this algorithmic system that looks really sort of objective and fair, but in reality, it's sort of harboring and becomes a Trojan horse of discrimination from years past. And that is one thing that I really want to make clear, is that with these algorithms, with these automated decision-making systems, they're based on a model of past data, right? And so if there are factors that lead to someone not repaying rent or being, you know, particularly vulnerable when being unhoused, or really sort of anything, fill in the blank, whether you're a good candidate for a credit card or something like that, then that's based off of, you know, historical circumstances with all of the discrimination from culture and laws that have been baked in for many years. And without laws in DC that specifically focus on automated decision-making systems and algorithms and accountability about that, then we sort of run the risk of not being able to tell and make sure that we are progressing and understanding how we're making decisions, but rather just being content with like refilling the past, but with a sort of technological glaze on it.
Wow, thank you for that. So, I mean, you know, as you mentioned, oftentimes people would show up to apply for an apartment, you know, or a condo or something, and whoever's making those decisions, whatever, you know, value set they have, they would see a person of color, for example, and, you know, make up an excuse. But in reality, it's a way to discriminate and keep people From so now that is digital, right?
Exactly. The term that had traditionally been used about redlining, where bank lenders would literally have lines around parts of a neighborhood and saying Black families, cannot move into this place. There, scholars have really called this now the digital redlining, and so this is really something that persists.
Wow. Cynthia and Ben, let's get a little deeper into how this affects people looking for housing or in the housing space. As, for example, as we do a lot of work around public housing, and just on a national level, what we're seeing is a change from the traditional public housing, as we know it, right? Large properties where people are housed. We're seeing the demolition, the disposition of these properties, and many of the people who live there are now getting vouchers to move somewhere, right? So theoretically, the idea is like, hey, here's this voucher that'll allow you to move somewhere better than what you're used to. However, there are now all of these these barriers for people actually being able to use these vouchers in a so-called better place or a better neighborhood. So talk to us about, how does this, and I know we've touched on it a little, but more directly, is this showing up in the housing space nowadays?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think Ben mentioned earlier that algorithmic discrimination spans the spectrum or all the phases of housing. So by which I mean, for example, people experiencing homelessness through the VSPIDAT test mentioned earlier, which I will note that the same system was also used in LA. And reporters found out that when it was used in LA, the system actually gave Black and Latina individuals who were homeless lower priority scores for housing compared to white individuals. So there's both socioeconomic discrimination, there's racial discrimination as well. And that's a pattern that we see over and over again when it comes to algorithmic discrimination, not just in housing, but in healthcare, education, many other areas as well. Then when it comes to tenants renting, for example, again, The Markup, an amazing publication, did a study where they showed that, first of all, 9 out of 10 landlords in a 2017 survey said that they were using automated background checks as part of their tenant screening processes. And these automated background service check services are notorious for inaccuracies, mistaken identity, and which seems to have a racist component as well too, because oftentimes they'll just take partial names, partial searches, or people who seem to have racialized similar names and conflate them all into the same person's record. So it could be one person applying for an apartment, their profile is fed in, and then the background check takes, say, four different people's criminal records and says, this is this person that did all of these things. And the landlord just sees that, or the landlord may not even see that, because depending on the service, they may not give any of those background details. They may just give a color code saying this is like a red, yellow, or green tenant candidate, or a certain score with no details behind it. And then when it comes to home ownership, there's also a lot of algorithmic discrimination when it comes to mortgage lending. So, for example, studies have shown that, again, Black and Brown aspiring homeowners will, for example, be rejected or accepted at a lower rate for mortgage lending, even if they are earning the same amount as their white counterparts and have less debt than their white counterparts. So you can imagine that multiplying across populations and across generations. And so you have tenants, unhoused, and aspiring homeowners. And then within that groups, I mentioned socioeconomic discrimination, but really, really impacts racialized residents of DC, because this is where we come back to redlining, right? Algorithms are basically a form of autocomplete of history, if you want to think of it that way, where they take patterns, and their whole goal is to replicate and entrench those patterns, not to depart from them, which is what we really should be trying to do. Virginia Eubanks, who's actually one of the co-authors of Ben's report and who wrote this fantastic book called Automating Inequality: How High-Tech Tools Profile, Police, and Punish the Poor, has this great phrase that she coined, feedback loops of injustice. And that's what these algorithms are, because The way you can think of it is, say you've been dealt a bad hand in life historically because of systemic racism, because of classism, or ableism. The algorithm takes all of that data and uses it as a reason to then deal you another bad hand over and over again, because that's what it sees has happened based on the data. And so if you imagine that multiplied over time, then you never get out of that loop. Discrimination just gets absolutely entrenched in our society. The other thing I think is important to note here is that both the racial discrimination aspect and the socioeconomic aspect is important, because as multiple people have shown, the lower income you are, the more socioeconomically disadvantaged you are, the more likely you are to have automated decision-making tools used on you. Because one thing we haven't said explicitly yet is that these tools, the reason they're called decision-making tools is because they either supplement or entirely replace human decision making, or what was formerly human decision making. So if someone is applying for a job with my business, for example, I could spend an hour sitting down talking with them in an interview, or I can just have them record a video of themselves answering questions that I've emailed them, and then I will just deploy a software algorithm, video analytics software, on that video. And the algorithm will just tell me, did this seem like a good candidate? Did they make eye contact? Did they match all the behavioral cues that past patterns have suggested match up with good candidates? And of course, you can imagine all the types of ableist and racialized discrimination and biases that would be fed into that. And so there's a very almost insidious systemic aspect to this, because it's so obvious that you can't imagine that someone applying for a CEO position would be subjected to, oh, okay, fill out this form, we'll feed it through an algorithm. Or I'm just thinking, for instance, like graduating from law school, just thinking the hundreds of dollars that law firms drop on treating law students, law candidates to dinners. Like, people in lower wage jobs are not going to get that human experience. And it gets even worse when you consider that one of the major drivers of these kinds of algorithmic decision-making tools across different sectors is the fact that all of these systems are so underfunded and under-resourced. So when you think about the results of austerity policies and budget cuts to the social safety net and public systems, that's healthcare, that's education, that's employment insurance, that's a big part of what's driving the adoption of these tools, because all of these regulators and agencies do not have the resources to, assuming that they want to do their jobs properly. And then you have these technology companies coming in like saviors, being like, oh, we have the solution, it is faster, it will be cheaper, you don't have to do anything, and it's scientific, it's mathematical, so just let us take care of it. But then of course what people don't realize is it's just discrimination in another form.
Wow. And the only thing I'll add there is that, you know, in reality, when these are applied for a housing context, for something, there is the Fair Credit Reporting Act and certain like stopgaps in place to allow people to, you know, change the record, or, you know, correct the record when someone's information is accidentally put in. But in reality, if you're applying for one of the only affordable units in your neighborhood, or near the place you need to go to school, or in DC at all, which, you know, in this district, but also many others, there's very few of these. You can't really realistically exercise your rights in correcting your record and still get that. You'll just miss out to the next person, or the person that doesn't need to do a credit check because they have enough income, or whatever that is. And so that's the same case with a job, as Cynthia was pointing out. Like, you, in reality, the person just misses out on that opportunity. And so, you know, it's really an insidious impact on each individual person.
Wow, thank you both for breaking that down. And just to share, it's a little suspect. My iPhone just gave me a little message that said, call into taking action, which is never done before. Like, it knows I'm on, and it knows I'm talking about this computer thing, which I was like, whoa, that's never happened before.
That's also a whole other episode.
Yes. We'll save that one for the future. Let's make sure, though, because we wanted to not only break down, you know, what the algorithm is, how it creates discrimination, But obviously, what is being done to hopefully guard against it, regulate against it? I know you all are having a training this week, and more specifically around housing discrimination through the algorithm. Talk to us a little bit about, well, give us the details and what folks can expect and how folks can join, because I think that's really important.
Absolutely. So this Friday, we are hosting a virtual teach-in on algorithmic housing discrimination. It is, again, Friday, December 15th at 12:30 p.m. to 2 p.m. Eastern Time. So we have a fantastic panel of speakers who most are all based here in DC, who are legal experts, researchers, and advocates at the intersection of fair housing, data bias, automated decision making, and technology justice. Specifically, we have organizations such as Upturn, the Equal Rights Center, the Fair Budget Coalition, at my organization, the Center on Privacy and Technology. And where this is coming from is all of these organizations, as well as Ben and Epic and ourselves, are part of a broader coalition. Behind, we all work on algorithmic discrimination, such as whether it's through regulatory proceedings or through legislative efforts, such as ours here in DC. This teach-in, though, will be focused particularly on algorithmic housing discrimination. So you can learn about what it is, examples, how people are fighting it on the ground. So Natasha Duarte from Upturn, for example, has been doing a lot of regulatory proceedings around it, such as at the Federal Trade Commission, at the CFPB, for example. Susie McClanahan is the senior manager of the Fair Housing Rights Program at Equal Rights Center, and I know they're engaged in a lot of fair housing litigation. So people who are engaging in lawsuits on fair housing issues. We also have Monique and Troy Murphy from the Fair Budget Coalition, who will be talking about a lot of firsthand experiences that they've had with housing discrimination in DC. And then closing us out, Yuan Zhang, who is a student attorney who's been working with us at the Communications and Technology Law Clinic at Georgetown Law, who will be providing a brief overview of the many bills that have been proposed at both the federal and state level to address different aspects of algorithmic discrimination or algorithmic accountability generally. And because it's a teach-in, we wanted to make sure that it was interactive and not just people being talked at or a bunch of talking heads, for example. So there will be some interactive components that people who wish to and share their stories of housing discrimination or share if they think, oh, I think I might have been subjected to a tenant screening algorithm, or I'm pretty sure that my resume was just, you know, fed to a robot and then I never heard back again, that they'll have an opportunity to share and talk with each other as well.
I'm sorry, after several years of doing this, I still forget to unmute. If folks want to get to register, to get the link, how can they do that?
Oh, thank you. Excellent question. So the link to register is tiny.cc/algorithmic-housing-discrim. We couldn't fit in the whole word discrimination, so it's tiny.cc/algorithmic-housing-discrim.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Folks, you are tuned in to Taking Action here on WPFW 89.3 FM. We are joined by Cynthia Koo. She's a senior associate at the Center on Privacy and Technology at Georgetown University Law Center. We're also joined by Ben Winter. He is a senior counsel at the Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC. And we've been talking about algorithmic discrimination and how it shows up. They are having a teach-in this Friday, which, I mean, if I have time, I'm going to make this, because this is now really, you know, really has caught my interest as somebody working in the housing space. And as we move to a more digital platform in trying to find housing for people, this is certainly, you know, something that we should all be aware of, especially if we're looking for housing. And this is a big issue here in the city. So thank you both for the information you've shared with us thus far. If anybody wants to join the conversation, has questions or any experiences they'd like to share, please feel free to give us a call, 202-588-0893. Once again, that number is 202-588-0893. I wanted to ask, how can someone tell if you know, algorithmic screening is being used against them? Like, how can they, how would they know, you know, who did it, how they did it? Is there a way to tell?
It's an excellent question. It really depends. So sometimes, you know, you will never really know what system is being used, to what extent, what type of decision it is recommending or output it's yielding, and how it actually affected the ultimate decision, whether you got rejected for housing or whether you got rejected for a job. It's very rarely going to be like, transparently, the algorithm says you're rejected or whatever. It's going to be integrated into a normal looking process to you, but oftentimes you will not know the extent to it. In regards to specifically applying for housing, the Fair Credit Reporting Act that I mentioned before, in theory, it makes it so you should be able to obtain a report of anything that you apply to. So you're supposed to be able to get a copy of that, to be able to dispute it, all of that stuff. But you still, at the end of the day, even if you are able to get all of that information, in which in reality you're often not, you wouldn't know, like, what sort of goes into that algorithm, what goes into that score, what the sources of all of the data that they're putting into that report is. So those essential aspects of it that are really necessary to be able to challenge in court or in negotiations or anything like that, that information is not compelled. And I guess, you know, part of my point is that you shouldn't have to get lucky with a transparent landlord or a transparent employer that is saying, hey, this is how this works. This is the company that you have to call if you have any problems. A lot of times it will be in fine print or not there at all. And again, to my point similarly to earlier, it's sometimes it's too late, right? You could find out and want to get information about it, you know, you don't want to, you either miss out on the opportunity or you don't have the time and bandwidth to be able to call these places and wait on hold and try to give more information to figure out what happened. And so that's why our groups and many other groups are advocating for legislation at local and state and federal levels to require this sort of proactive transparency to limit certain, you know, some of the most problematic stuff, because again, you shouldn't have to get lucky to get the information that's necessary.
That's right. Cynthia, anything to add?
Yeah, so I tried to think of ways that someone might be able to tell, and it was indeed difficult because, I mean, you could ask them outright if they use companies such as RealPage or CoreLogic or RentGrow, but of course not everyone is going to know off the top of their head the names of all these different tenant screening companies. I was also thinking if you were asked to fill out a lot of personal details in a form, especially an online form, never once spoke to anyone, and then someone just comes back to you with a rejection that they can't explain. But of course, that could easily hide a human not wanting to admit that they're discriminating, as well as the fact that they just used a technological screening method. The other thing is that because of that TransUnion survey that showed 9 out of 10 landlords use automated background check services, it's almost a matter of, you could almost assume that they're being used, which then goes back to what Ben said about that's almost not the problem, right? Like, transparency is not enough, because it's not enough for them to tell us that they're doing the bad thing. We want them not to be doing the bad thing at all in the first place. So it points to a bigger problem, which is just the massive power imbalance and information asymmetry between people who are in need of housing and these massive companies that are profiting off of this broken housing system. Because when you think about even how you launch a lawsuit in the first place, you need evidence to ground your claims in, right? But what do you do when all of the evidence is in the hands of the party that you're suing, and they have no incentive to give it to you so that you can use it to sue them? And that goes back to why we need legislation to force a baseline level of transparency, so we can even have a hope of getting some modicum of accountability.
Well, thank you. And I think that begs the next question. Like, this appears to be like a highly unregulated world, or whatever you want to call it, right? Because it's virtual, or it's, you know, well, there's humans behind it. But it appears that, I mean, people are making a lot of money and creating, you know, these new systems with very little regulation. Is that true? Like, is this illegal? Has anyone challenged it? So many questions around that. Anything to respond to that?
Yeah. The legality of some of the use of systems is really sort of in the courts right now, being litigated in different jurisdictions, to be honest, you know, about how it complies with certain, you know, civil rights provisions, whether it complies with, as I've mentioned a few times, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, you know, whether the things that are currently in use are actually being used in line with sort of legacy laws. And that's a sort of common theme when we talk about the AI regulation that we advocate for regularly, is that we can sort of walk and chew gum at the same time, right? So there's active questions about how the laws we've always had, or not always, but for the last 50 years or so have had, you know, and how that is applied to the current uses. But at the same time, we can get ahead of that a little bit and directly talk about, you know, how we can get greater, more specific transparency, how we can build in requirements that are unique to the ways in which powerful, the entities that are in a higher power position, like a landlord or an employer, have to disclose in order to sort of, or, you know, have to disclose, do, not do, in order to sort of, you know, bridge that power gap between them and the person that is applying to them. And, you know, there have been a few different efforts throughout the country and world, honestly, to address this. At the federal level, there have been proposals, but really nothing passed, about algorithms in housing. That includes a bill from Senator Booker and Representative Clark a few years ago about facial recognition use in public housing. That's a whole other thing about even just getting into your housing once you have that. But, you know, more specifically to what we've been talking about in terms of evaluating people's tendency or likelihood of doing a given action, the Algorithmic Accountability Act, which was a federal bill introduced now for the third time in 2019, 2022, and 2023, that requires sort of a minimum level of transparency, gives people sort of higher, you know, easier rights to ask questions and challenge the decisions of algorithms in sort of sensitive domains. And so that sensitive domain sort of classifier is housing, public benefits, employment. You know, you can sort of imagine what those high risk things are. So that's at the federal level. Nothing really has passed. But again, people are starting to try to challenge it based off of those federal bills like the Civil Rights Act, you know, Fair Housing Act, all of those. And on the local level, and local and state level, in California, there is the Fair Employment and Housing Coalition agency, I think it's a commission, not a coalition, is currently drafting regulations about how exactly they want to require landlords in their state to comply with civil rights laws and things like that. So there are a few individual states and localities that are starting to act on this, but not really, to be honest. A lot of things have not passed. And Cynthia can talk a little bit more about the current pending bill, impending bill last year, the Stop Discrimination by Algorithms Act right here in DC, which is one of the, you know, more prominent efforts to get, you know, all of these sort of sensitive algorithms regulated in a given jurisdiction.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you. And a great setup, because that's where I wanted to ask about the local bill. Cynthia, if you would talk to us a little bit about the bill.
Sure. So this bill, it's called the DC Stop Discrimination by Algorithms Act. It was originally introduced by the former Attorney General Carl Racine as a kind of a intended, he was a champion of the bill, and it got through hearing at DC Council. Actually, it was granted a 7-hour hearing at DC Council. Apparently, it's one of the bills that's gotten the most interest at DC Council, because so many people came out in support of and were honest in opposition to it. from industry and business, for instance. And this bill does several things. So I'll talk about what it does and then why it's unique from a lot of the other bills that we've seen at the federal and state levels that purport to regulate algorithms, AI, or algorithmic discrimination. So it does two things substantively. It has two substantive prohibitions. It bans algorithmic eligibility determinations, which basically means eligibility for important life opportunities that are covered in the DC Human Rights Act, whether that is in education, employment, healthcare, housing, for example. So the SDAA is tied to the DC Human Rights Act because we kind of see it as a civil rights law and anti-discrimination law for the 21st century. The other thing it does is it bans discriminatory use. So the incorporation of protected traits like race, gender, age, and so on in algorithmic information availability determinations, which in plain English means targeted ads. So you may have heard, for example, that people can use Facebook ads to discriminate based on race and gender in their job ads and their housing ads. And that even when Facebook removed the ability for people creating the ads to do that, the discrimination was still happening anyway because of how the algorithms operate and because so many different parts of people's profiles, because of these patterns, can be used as proxies for race and gender and age anyway. And so the bill would ban that as well. Then it pairs these substantive bans with notice and reporting and auditing obligations. And that's to get at that transparency piece, because we don't want companies to be able to claim willful ignorance. There's a great op-ed by Kathy O'Neill, who wrote a book called Weapons of Math Destruction about algorithmic discrimination. And she wrote this op-ed that said, so she has a company that offers algorithmic auditing services, that companies who want to be good actors saying, okay, we want to set up this algorithmic decision-making system, but we also want to make sure it's not biased, if that is possible. Can you come in and assess it and evaluate it? And then someone from within the company she has experienced will call her in, will be really enthusiastic, and then she'll get passed on to progressively higher people within the company, higher rank people, until suddenly the calls will stop or someone will come back to her and say, no, we don't want this after all. And that's because they want to preserve their plausible deniability, because if they find out that the algorithmic decision-making system is discriminatory, then they're obligated to do something about it. And so they benefit from that opacity and obscurity. So what this bill does is to try and force some sunlight onto these algorithmic decision-making systems, where even if they aren't necessarily releasing it to the public, because if there are trade secret concerns or competition concerns, they at least have to do the work themselves and have to report it to the Office of the Attorney General of DC. And so we're hoping that we'll at least get some of the information out there, so that if there is something to be done, you can't know what needs fixing if you don't actually have the information in the first place. And then finally, this bill comes with enforcement provisions. So the DCOAG can bring action if a company violates the law, and also individuals who are harmed have a private right of action, i.e. they can sue if they're harmed by a company under this bill. So it's the combination of the fact that because the SDA is comprehensive, it covers all of the sectors that are covered in the DC Human Rights Act, which other bills don't necessarily do. And it has these enforcement teeth, which other bills or other comprehensive frameworks don't necessarily have. It's the combination of those two things that we think puts DC in such a good position to, while being in good company with all of these other states federally and other countries and regions of the world trying to regulate AI right now, still has an opportunity to really take a leadership role and to set a standard for the rest of the country.
Well, thank you. And as you were speaking, I just looked it up on the council's website, and there's two bills. Is there a distinction between? There was one introduced by Mendelsohn, which I would imagine on behalf of the former attorney general. There's also one by Robert White. Are they one and the same, or
Yes. So a bit of procedural history. What happened is, I think I got a bit off track. So the GRSC introduced the bill, and then after the hearing, that happened to be towards the end of the last legislative session. So it died at the end of 2022. And DC Council legislative sessions run in periods of 2 years. So it got reintroduced at the beginning of this year, 2023, not by the Attorney General, now new Attorney General, but by Councilmember Robert White at DC Council, along with four other co-sponsors. And so that's where the bill is now. Specifically, it is sitting with the Councilmember Kenyon McDuffie's Committee on Business and Economic Development. So if you are listening and are interested and want to see this bill become law in DC, he is the one that you should be calling and emailing right now. And if it doesn't get passed before the end of next year, 2024, then it will die again. So we are really trying to drive a major effort both locally and nationally right now to make this bill happen.
No, that's right. And just for folks who do a lot of council advocacy, the co-signers are Anita Bonds, Janice Lewis-George, Charles Allen, and Zachary Parker. Let's remind folks that we are almost nearing the end of the show. Let's remind folks about the teach-in this Friday, the details for that, and how they can join.
Sure. So it's a virtual teach-in on algorithmic housing discrimination. Takes place this Friday, December 15th at 12:30 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time. And you can register by going to tiny.cc/algorithmic-housing-discrim. I also had one other thing that I wanted to make sure to say, but I've been talking for a while, so maybe we'll hand it to Ben first in case he had anything to add.
No, please go ahead.
I think I lost it. It was the question of what makes algorithmic discrimination, right? So it actually earlier was a perfect, it was in response to a question of, is algorithmic discrimination illegal or shouldn't it already be illegal? And that was a perfect set because we get this question a lot when we talk about the SDAA to people, because they say, well, isn't discrimination already illegal? And in my view, the answer is yes, and it should be, but also there's a lot of room for courts to do something funny if someone actually brings litigation. And so just to go a bit more in depth to that, I think in our experience, sometimes combining deeply entrenched societal problems with new technologies, the new technology part can cause people's thinking to get a little bit messy, and they can go in one or two of two extreme directions. On the one hand, some people treat the new technology as too special. They're like, this changes everything. Nothing has like this has ever happened before. And they apply really ahistorical views. So for example, in my other work at the center, I work on worker surveillance and automated management of workers. And we all know, most of us, Frederick Taylor and Henry Ford are poster children of turning workers into exploited automatons. Amazon didn't invent that just because Amazon has now a lot more technology with which to do that. So part of the job is reminding people that everything new is old. On the other hand, some people go in the other extreme direction and they think technology changes nothing, even though we know in our lives it absolutely has. So my go-to example for that is the issues of hate speech and freedom of expression on online platforms and misinformation. So in the past, people would say, oh, well, the best way to counter hate speech and misinformation is to just drown it out with good speech and good arguments, which is just so laughably quaint in today's social media environment. So you have to explain, okay, well, here is why technology does change the things that matter. So to bring it back to algorithmic discrimination, you can see how a similar thing might happen in the housing context. On the one hand, you could say, well, discrimination is discrimination. It's illegal under the DCHRA. We should just move on. And ideally, that is what would happen. But because of these intermediating layers of new technologies, a landlord might say, well, it wasn't my fault. The software developer created the biased algorithms, and they told me that it would work fine and be neutral, and I have no idea how they make it or why they put that. So really, it's the software developer's fault. I just trusted in their science. Meanwhile, the technology vendor who created and sold the software can say, well, I'm not responsible. I just sell this technology. I can't control what the landlord does with it after it's off the shelf. And so you basically end up with a responsibility shell game where the two entities involved and who are most profiting can disclaim responsibility, but it cannot be that no one ends up being accountable. Like, that obviously that's not the right solution. Tenants aren't discriminating against themselves. So instead of leaving this all up in the air to hope that the courts are happy, the case falls before a tech-savvy judge, and to force people through drawn out expensive litigation just to vindicate rights they should already have, it just seems so much more straightforward and equitable to have legislation that explicitly sets out what the case should be.
The other thing about, to Cynthia's great point there about, yes, we have, you know, this is already illegal. The problem is that right now, you know, a person doesn't have the information needed to make their case in court necessarily a lot of times, right? You know, there's that plausible deniability of like, we don't know exactly what went into it. We don't control that. It's only part of the decision-making process. There's all that fill in the blank. And so there is additional regulation needed in order to give people the tools to adequately enforce those existing discrimination rights.
And Cynthia, as you were talking about, you know, like the shell game of like who's responsible, it almost reminds me of like the gun rights stuff, like guns don't kill people, people kill people, to kind of just move the blame away from, you know, that whole industry behind that is very successful at selling guns that of course do kill people. Right. So, you know, thank you for making those connections. As we begin to wrap up, just the last quick question, aside from the teach-in, which I think, you know, I encourage people to join, it affects so many of us either looking for housing or doing work around housing here in the district. How else can people get involved around this issue? What other avenues make folks, you know, join, websites they should check out, anything if people want to get more involved in around this issue?
Yes, so there are two ways in addition to the teach-in here in DC. The first is what I mentioned: contact, write, email, call your council member if you are interested in this bill. If you happen to have a lot of time and can contact multiple council members, then the order I would suggest is starting with council member Kenyon McDuffie, whose committee currently has the bill. Then I would move on to council member Brooke Pinto, because her committee, Judiciary and Public Safety, is the next one that the bill has to pass through. And then alongside them, contact your representative, the council member for your ward. Let them know that this is something you care about, that the community cares about, and that they should pay attention to. Because if they think that nobody cares, then they may not care, and then the bill may die. Related to that, the third thing is our friends and colleagues at Consumer Reports have actually set up a form that makes it very easy for you to contact Councilmember McDuffie. If you, I don't have the exact URL, but if you Google Consumer Reports and Stop Discrimination by Algorithms Act, I am sure their action page will come up where you just fill in your information. They will generate it. I think they even have a template email for you. So they make it really easy to do that.
Awesome. Thank you. Ben, anything to add? Anything about the report your organization published?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely encourage folks to read our Screened and Scored in the District of Columbia report if you want to get a clearer picture of exactly what these tools are and how they might actually impact people. I also will reiterate, one of the authors of the report wrote a book, Virginia Eubanks, Automating Inequality, as well as many other books about algorithmic bias, including Kathy O'Neill's Weapons of Math Destruction, which I always think is a really great title. And it's really runs home. And then the last book I'll recommend for folks is a book by Ruha Benjamin. And that is exactly a really great summary of how the sort of racial history and racial discrimination gets into algorithms and gets exacerbated by those. And then more importantly, I think just generally, I would encourage people, listeners, to talk to their council people and representatives at the federal level, of course, but also just talk to your friends, talk to your parents, you know, take that stigma away that this is like a big scary algorithm that you can't possibly understand because you don't know how to, computer science works. It's really a series of political and human decisions and you know, sort of putting your hands up and saying that you're not a tech expert is exactly what the companies want you to be able to do. So, you know, just be confident in that you can ask questions of other people and make it clear that you are paying attention and understand this is a really important issue.
Well, I want to thank you both for the work that you're doing, for educating us on this topic this afternoon. Let's definitely make sure to continue checking in on how those efforts are going here in the district. And just continued success. Encourage folks to join the teach-in this coming Friday. And I just want to say thank you again. Thank you for making the time.
Thank you, Daniel, so much.
Wonderful. Well, folks, stay tuned for the news in just a second. And then you've got COVID, Race, and Democracy right after. Thank you. We'll catch you next Tuesday.
From WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Tuesday, December 12th. Here are some headlines. Harvard University President Claudine Gay will continue to lead the university despite calls for her removal after controversial congressional testimony regarding campus anti-Semitism last week. Today, the Harvard Corporation, Harvard University's highest governing body, rejected calls to fire President Gay. The decision came after more than 700 faculty members signed an open letter calling on the Harvard Corporation to, quote, defend the independence of the university and to resist political pressures that are at odds with Harvard's commitment to academic freedom, including calls for the removal of President Claudine Gay, close quote. Gay was inaugurated in October as the first African-American and second woman to lead Harvard University. The announcement that she will stay in the job comes just days after University of Pennsylvania President Liz McGill, who also testified last week, resigned her position on Saturday. COP28, the Global Climate Summit, went into overtime today with no deal yet on the meeting's final agreement. Many nations criticized a draft text for a deal released yesterday for failing to call for a phase out of fossil fuels, the root cause of rising global temperatures. The draft agreement instead calls on countries to reduce consumption and production of fossil fuels in a just, orderly, and equitable manner. It's a watering down of earlier versions and an apparent concession to oil-producing nations which had opposed the measure. More than 100 countries support a phase-out of fossil fuels in some form. Others, such as Saudi Arabia, have pushed against the inclusion of any reference to fossil fuels in the final deal. The U.S. Supreme Court said yesterday that it would consider Special Counsel Jack Smith's request to rule quickly on whether presidential immunity protects former President Trump from prosecution in the federal 2020 election interference case. U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan, who is to preside over the first ever criminal trial of a former president, rejected the immunity claim on December 1st. Lawyers for Trump appealed that ruling to a federal appeals court. Appeal proceedings could delay Trump's criminal trial, which is due to begin the day before Super Tuesday. Smith asked the Supreme Court to bypass the appeals court and take up the case itself on an emergency basis. And 18 California children are suing the Environmental Protection Agency, claiming it violated their constitutional rights by failing to protect them from the effects of climate change. The federal lawsuit was filed by Our Children's Trust on Sunday in U.S. District Court in the Central District of California. It alleges that since the EPA was created 5 decades ago, it has let the U.S. become one of the world's biggest emitters of planet-warming pollution, despite knowing how this would harm children. The plaintiffs argue that they are particularly vulnerable to pollution and climate change impacts, given their still developing lungs and bodies. They are asking the federal court to hold a trial, weigh the evidence, and ultimately issue a declaratory judgment that the EPA has violated their fundamental constitutional rights to life and equal protection of the law. And in weather today in Washington, D.C., it is 46 degrees and